Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
And a very good morning to you on this Wednesday, the 17th of June. Welcome to Africa Link. I'm Mark Caldwell in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, Cameroon urges its Muslim leaders to join a campaign against the ideology of the Islamic State.
I am calling on the Cameroonian people to be vigilant and also warning whoever collaborates with Islamic State ideology or any form of extremism to know that Cameroon is solidly one and indivisible.
And unfinished business in South Africa, 25 years after measures were launched to end apartheid.
Are we focusing more on ensuring that the wealth is more evenly distributed and reducing the increasing divides between our people?
Those stories and more coming up in the next 25 minutes.
Top story.
We begin in Cameroon, where the country has assembled all of its Muslim leaders in the capital Yaoundé to tell them how to identify and campaign against those who promote the ideology of Islamic State. The move follows reports that the Nigerian Islamist militant group Boko Haram, which proclaimed allegiance to IS last year, is stepping up efforts to spread its extremist message. From Yaoundé, Moki Kinseka reports.
Oh Allah, nous te prions et te demandons d'éradiquer le secte Boko Haram.
This is Muslim cleric Imam Nuridini praying. He is calling on Allah's divine intervention to help Cameroon defeat the Nigerian Islamist group Boko Haram. Imam Dini and hundreds of Cameroonian Muslim clerics have gathered for a workshop to understand Boko Haram's latest strategies in spreading religious fundamentalism. The meeting begins and ends with prayers. Since it announced an allegiance to the Islamic State or IS, an Islamist organization holding territories in Iraq and Syria, the Boko Haram carried out ruthless attacks in Nigeria and in Cameroon, killing scores of people. But in March, the Nigerian militants began suffering defeat in the hands of regional allied forces from Cameroon, Chad, Nigeria, and Niger. The group has lost most of its strongholds in Nigeria. Cameroonian authorities believe preaching fundamentalism is now one of Boko Haram's top strategies, along with suicide attacks. Kavai Yege Jibril, who doubles as Speaker of Cameroon's National Assembly, and traditional and Muslim leader of Mada, a town on the Nigerian border, emphasizes that it is important having the 300 Cameroonian Islamic scholars present here to understand this aspect of the war against Boko Haram.
I am calling on the Cameroonian people to be vigilant and also warning whoever collaborates with Islamic State ideology or any form of extremism to know that Cameroon is solidly one and indivisible.
Yaoundé-based cleric Umaru Mustafa says many Cameroonians, especially unemployed youths, are victims of the ideology espoused by the extremist group and fears they may start violence.
It is forbidden for a Muslim to maltreat an animal, let alone maltreating a human being.
Sheikh Nsangu Mama of the Union of African Muslim Scholars, who have together with Cameroon's Islamic Cultural Association organized the meeting to detect and denounce extremism, says since the Nigerian militant group Boko Haram announced its allegiance to IS, they have been educating Muslims on how to identify people sharing their ideology.
People who say that they want to implement Islamic State at all costs and by all means, forgetting about the fundamentals of Islam. The solution is to go back to these teachings, to understand them the way the Prophet understood them and the way he talked to them to his companions.
And that report was compiled by Maki Kinseka in Yaounde. And Boko Haram has been blamed for twin suicide bombings that killed 24 people and wounded more than 100 in the capital of Chad, Angelina, on Monday. President Idriss Deby vowed the following day that there would be no impunity for those who were behind the attacks. My colleague Assumpta Lartus asked Sebastian Elischer from the German Institute of Global and Area Studies in Hamburg whether the Chadian government would be implementing tighter security measures.
Most likely, even though it has to be said that security in general is already pretty tight in the capital and in the surrounding areas, given that Chad has been governed pretty autocratically for the last 25 years, security by virtue of definition is rather high. It's likely that the government in place will use this incident to further crack down on the terrorists themselves or on alleged terrorists.
Chad and the international community were really fast to put the blame on Boko Haram, but Boko Haram haven't said anything as yet. So could someone else be responsible for this attack?
I think it's entirely plausible that Boko Haram is behind this, and it's entirely plausible that it might be sort of a jihadi terrorist attack, but it's also quite likely that it might be someone else, that it might be members of the former rebels who failed to overthrow the regime in 2008, and it's also likely that it might be another terrorist group that is operating inside of Chad. In other words, those might be sympathizers of Boko Haram, because it is well known that there are Salafi groups or potentially violent Salafi groups being present on Chadian territory. At this stage, it's very, very difficult to exclude any of these solutions. I'm not surprised that Chad would blame Boko Haram instantly. After all, it was the terrorists and the security crisis in neighboring Nigeria that made the Chadian president appear like a proper statesman and not as the rebel leader that he is.
Let's assume that it was Boko Haram that carried out this attack. How big a setback could this be in the fight against Boko Haram?
This wouldn't be so much of a setback. I assume it would be more like a shift into another territory. Boko Haram has been very active in large parts of northern Nigeria. They have failed to make serious inroads into neighboring Niger. And if it really was Boko Haram, then this might indicate a shift to focusing their energy to a country which has been involved in the war against Islamic terror, but which so far has not been the theater of terrorist attacks.
How do you see the Boko Haram network working in Chad?
Boko Haram is known to have sympathizers in Chad. And the Chadian government, in its official statements, might have downplayed this, but talking to some government civil servants off the record, it's well known that Boko Haram sympathizers are operating in some of the islands on the Lake Chad and are also known to be present in some of the remote areas.
Sebastian Elischer.
Africa Link. Every weekday on DW Deutsche Welle.
In Burundi, weeks of protest over President Pierre Nkurunziza's bid for a third term in office have left about 40 people dead and displaced more than 100,000. In a move to defuse tension, the African Union is deploying military experts to the country to oversee the disarming of the militia and other armed groups. Assumpta Lartus asked Yolande Buka, an expert on Burundi at the Institute for Security Studies in Nairobi, whether it was known when and how the disarmament process was going to take place.
We don't know yet, and it's quite an interesting development. If we recall, the government has always denied arming its youth group. So the fact that the African Union has decided to send military personnel to follow up on this is quite interesting. Most importantly, we also know that a lot of the youth group involved in Burundi are mostly political. But I think what's the most interesting part is for the government to accept this presence in Burundi, given the fact that it has continuously denied ARMY, its youth arm of the political party.
Will this calm the opposition and rights activists who apparently don't want the postponement of the elections, but President Nkurunziza to relinquish power and not run for third term?
I think it definitely addresses some of the issues going on the ground and some of the concerns of the opposition. There's been increased reports of the Imbonerakure, which is a youth group of the ruling party, intimidating the population in different parts of the country. They've also been accused of violence against some portion of the population. So this disarmament process, if it goes through as planned, would definitely address one of the concerns of the opposition. But there remains the issue of the free press, the issue of the opposition being able to campaign freely throughout the country, and harassment of civil society organization leaders, and of course the third mandate issue, which remains at the heart of the controversy between the opposition and the ruling party.
Now, African leaders have called for a political solution to the crisis in Burundi. And what could a political solution look like?
A political solution would first require one or both parties to move away from their maximalist positions. The maximalist positions, on one hand, with the ruling party, is that President Nkurunziza's candidacy is non-negotiable. And on the other hand, the opposition's position is that there would be no negotiation, or there would be no concession with regards to the third mandate. So I think a political solution would create an environment in which all parties involved can participate in the elections freely, in safety, with the presence and the support of the international community and regional actors. And then we'd have to make a decision, whether it's domestically, but also internationally, about the status of the candidacy of the president at the moment. And I think this is one, whether either the opposition would relinquish their demands and allow President Nkurunziza to run, or President Nkurunziza would have to withdraw his candidacy. The latter option, however, seems very unlikely.
Yolanda Buka speaking from Nairobi.
Behind the headlines.
1990 was a momentous year in South Africa. It saw the start of reforms launched by President de Klerk, which were to lead to the abolition of apartheid. 25 years ago this week, he introduced first measures to Parliament. Subri Govender takes us back a quarter of a century.
Several laws were part of South Africa's system of racial segregation. The Natives Land Act of 1913, which restricted black ownership of land to only 13% of the land that could be described as the most arid and devastated areas of the country. The Group Areas Act of 1950, which regulated residential segregation of the people according to race and preserved the most valuable and serviced areas for the white minority. The Population Registration Act, which classified people according to race, and the Reservation of Separate Amenities Act, which enforced the segregation of all public facilities and preserved the best municipal facilities such as swimming pools, beaches, and sporting areas for the white minority. When introducing measures to scrap these laws, de Klerk told the apartheid parliament that he and his government were serious in changing the political situation so that there could be peaceful negotiations for a new constitutional and democratic order.
These decisions by the cabinet are in accordance with the government's declared intention to normalize the political process in South Africa, a new democratic constitution, equality before an independent judiciary, a sound economy based on proven economic principles and private enterprise, dynamic programs directed at better education, health services, housing, and social conditions for all.
The new moves to scrap South Africa's apartheid laws earned him the wrath of right-wing white opposition parties and extremists. But de Klerk was unshaken by the venomous attacks and instead appealed to the white parliament and the international community. Leaders of the black majority, including Nelson Mandela, congratulated de Klerk for his courage and bravery. Here's Mandela at a mass rally in Johannesburg in December 1990.
Mr. de Klerk has gone further than any other nationalist president in taking real steps to normalize the situation. It must be added that Mr. de Klerk himself is a man of integrity.
Today, however, while the apartheid laws are no longer in force, not much has changed in the privileges and advantages that the white minority enjoyed. There has also not been much change in so far as land ownership is concerned. Yunus Karim, a former political activist who is a member of parliament and a former government minister, says they understand that despite the abolition of apartheid laws, inequality has grown for many people.
Government is aware of this. We're focusing more on ensuring that the wealth is more evenly distributed and reducing the increasing divides between our people.
There's no doubt that while the black majority have political power and control, access to a better life is still a distant dream for a large percentage of the people.
Sobri Govender reporting. Ghana was supposed to switch from analog to digital broadcasting today. But a couple of months ago, Ghana had to admit that it just doesn't have the money to complete the transition. It has now set itself a new target of early 2016. And as Maxwell Souk found out, many Ghanaians are quite happy with the delay.
Azura Moses and his family have their eyes glued to a 24-inch analog television set in their living room in Tamale, in northern Ghana. They are watching a discussion on how to prevent disasters on a local television medium transmitting from Accra. Moses says watching TV in the evenings is what keeps them together after a long working day.
To be honest, TV keeps us informed about what is happening elsewhere in the country. It is also our source of entertainment.
Most Ghanaians depend on their analog television sets to access information. However, a June 17 deadline set by the International Telecommunication Union required African governments to ensure that all broadcasting is done digitally henceforth. That means people like Moses will no longer be able to watch TV unless they purchase a decoder. But many here simply can't afford it, says Alhassan Nafisa, a resident in Tamale.
The cost of living currently in Ghana is very bad. So adding additional cost of buying receivers, decoders, as well as monthly subscription just to get information will be a burden to the ordinary Ghanaian.
Ghana failed to meet the deadline to switch from analog to digital broadcasting because it failed to secure a loan from a Chinese bank. Minister of Communication Edward Omane Boama said at a press conference last April. This switchover seems to be a major problem in West Africa, and experts have criticized the various governments for the apparent lack of progress for the digital migration. In addition to Ghana, Mali, Burkina Faso, and Nigeria will also fail to make the switch to digital broadcasting by the deadline. The board of directors of the Media Foundation for West Africa is concerned, says the foundation's executive director, Suleiman Ibrahima.
The board actually expressed very deep concern about the low level of public awareness of the digital migration process and therefore called on the media and civil society groups in West Africa to support public education efforts in order to prepare citizens in their respective countries to be aware of the digital migration process.
Justice Bochi sells used television sets in Tamale. When I arrived, a buyer had come to bargain for a digital television set. Bochi said he has to educate his buyers before selling it out.
Some of them is digital, some of them is analog. So we explain things to you. The flat screen that he bought it, if the digital comes here, it can still use.
Ghana's Communication Minister Edward Omane Boama said the government is committed to the migration process to be completed by February 2016.
Maxwell Souk reporting.
Opinion.
And in Opinion this week, we focus on Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir. Although he faces an international arrest warrant, he was able to slip quietly out of South Africa earlier this week after attending an African Union summit. Here's DW's Lutka Shadomsky with this week's opinion piece, read now by Daniel Peltz.
Omar al-Bashir flees from the AU summit. International headlines screamed on July 16, 2013. That was almost 2 years ago, when al-Bashir was able to escape possible detention by Nigerian prosecutors by leaving the country prematurely. The outcry in parts of Africa was great, the strongest condemnation coming from the South African government. Bashir is wanted by the International Criminal Court to answer charges of genocide, war crimes and crimes against humanity committed in the western Sudanese province of Darfur. South Africa promised to arrest the fugitive leader, should he ever dare to enter South African soil. And then al-Bashir dared. He flew in for the 25th African Union summit in Johannesburg. But on Monday, in defiance of an arrest warrant given by a South African court, al-Bashir departed to Khartoum, jetting out from a military base near Pretoria with the active support of the very same South African government, just as it was in Nigeria. Local human rights groups in South Africa had filed for his warrant. The two incidents should not come as a surprise, as the Sudanese president continues to explore the boundaries of African solidarity. With all its lip service exposed, the South African government now finds itself drawn into the al-Bashir debate. On June 5th, South Africa's foreign minister had assured diplomatic immunity to all delegates attending the AU summit. Some African leaders may well have quietly welcomed the publicity surrounding Bashir, as it distracted attention from other pressing issues. Jacob Zuma was facing criticism from fellow leaders over the recent xenophobic attacks in his country. There was also a lack of progress over the European migration crisis at the EU summit. That issue may preoccupy European government leaders, but not the African politicians who force hundreds of thousands to leave their respective countries. The incident in Johannesburg carries a devastating message. South Africa and Nigeria, both Africa's political and economic heavyweights, have openly gone against the International Criminal Court, whose chief prosecutor, by the way, is an African, which makes it hard to believe she is pursuing a neo-colonialist witch hunt against African leaders, a narrative that African dictators like to peddle. The three heads of state from Burundi, Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo were also in South Africa. Interestingly, all of them are currently considering running for an unconstitutional third term, thus raising the prospects of a popular uprising. One may call it a slap in the face that during the summit, Rwanda's ruling party nominated its authoritarian leader Paul Kagame to vie for another third term. Germany had originally been particularly supportive for the International Criminal Court and the prosecution of human rights abuses committed in Darfur. However, recently, Berlin has adopted a less stringent approach to the atrocities in Sudan. Germany's foreign, defense and development ministries have yet to explain how this new stance towards Khartoum can profitably coexist with their newfound sense of responsibility towards Africa. Whoever did not know about the myth of the African lion leaping forward towards a democratic future spurred on by double-digit economic growth now knows it is just that, a fairy tale. Already in the coming year, the economic forecast has been significantly revised downwards in the face of falling world market prices. The balance sheet is even gloomier considering the ongoing armed conflicts from Somalia to Mali. That a former coup general in Nigeria is now celebrated as a beacon of hope says a lot about the current internal state of affairs in Africa. Finally, while addressing his colleagues at the AU summit in Johannesburg, Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe said, if the people only wanted a leader to rule for 2 terms, then that leader should resign after 2 terms in office. The Zimbabwean dictator is on his 7th term in office. It is bad for Africa, even without Sudan's al-Bashir.
Daniel Peltz with an opinion piece written by Lutka Shadomsky. And please let us know what you think of President Bashir and how he was able to evade arrest in South Africa. You can send an email to feedback.africa@dw.de, a letter to Africa Link, DW 53110, Bonn, Germany, or a text message to country code 49160957595 1-0. Our main stories. Cameroon is assembling its Muslim leaders to encourage them to campaign against Islamic State ideology. The African Union is deploying military experts to Burundi to oversee the disarming of the militia and other armed groups. And we've also been hearing about the future of digital broadcasting in Ghana. This programme, Africa Link, will be back at the same time tomorrow. As always, thank you for listening. This is Mark Caldwell in Bonn.